So welcome to Rethink Retirement, a Next Up podcast. We're here to show you how you can use your skills and experience as you move into retirement or unretirement, as we like to call it. I'm Victoria Tomlinson.
And I'm Trevor Hatton. And in each episode, we invite a guest to share their story of leaving working life and starting new things. And we both know what a challenging time this can be. So we hope these episodes will help you with ideas and perhaps inspire you if you're finding things harder than you expected at the moment.
Well, and today's guest is really inspiring because she's Amelia Dalton, and she has travelled the world for work, mostly on boats large and small. And then later in life, she's not retired like many of our guests have been, but she's extended all of this and she's turned it into a book, Pages from My Passport. And when I read something about this book, I wanted to see how Amelia had turned her work travel experiences into a fantastic book. And she's got plaudits from Alexander McCall Smith and Lee Darrell. And then I thought, gosh, what a great podcast guest she would be. So, Amelia, thank you for my reaching out, as we say these days, and joining us. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Very good to meet you and in lovely Yorkshire. And thank you for having me.
So, Amelia, could you just tell us a bit about your story? And how you got to this point, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all. It's quite a, like many people, by the time they get to what I suppose they're looking at retirement, there are quite a lot of things in one's life. I think my abiding conviction all the way through my life, probably come from my father, was that I felt very strongly that I was not going to get towards the end of my life, which one has to recognise, and look over my shoulder and think, I wish I had done this, I had done that. I think it's important to grasp the nettle, grasp the opportunities, and make the most of what is available. Equally, one has to create one's opportunities. Life doesn't come to you on a plate. You've got to make the most of it and create it.
So, Amelia, just tell us a bit then about kind of this life that you've been creating then and the opportunities you've grasped. So let's just hear a bit about kind of where you started out.
Well, I started, I suppose, you know, I was, you know, happily married, two children, a dog, very financially comfortable with a background in cooking and antiques. And my second youngest son was not at all strong. He had a condition which called Ehlers-Danlos, which is quite well known now. It was not known at all when he was born. And it was a struggle to keep him alive. He was bright, intelligent, but physically not at all strong. And after 2 years, my father, who was involved with raising money for the National Trust for Scotland for the island of St Kilda, he felt that he should see this place that he was raising money for. And he insisted I joined him. He chartered a Scottish fishing boat with a collection of friends. And he insisted that I would go with him with my now ex-husband. And off we went to St Kilda, a week on a trawler on the west coast of Scotland. And I fell in love with the whole thing. I loved being at sea. I liked the sense of freedom, and it was enormous fun. And after that, for several years, we chartered that boat as a family with other families. It suited my son Digby very well. It was a little microcosm of a world going around that he could be fully engaged with. And unlike some people, he never got seasick. So he actually was better than some, which was good for him. And after a few years, the couple who ran that boat were accused wrongly of stealing. And I, as a friend of theirs, felt very strongly that this was wrong. My father was a judge, and I felt strongly that it was wrong. They were accused of this. So I set about squashing the accusation, which I succeeded in doing, but they were out of a job. And so some of us who'd been on this boat agreed that we'd set up a company, buy a boat and give them a job. And I persuaded the National Trust for Scotland to give us their contract to take people to St Kilda. They have an annual allocation, work parties who go there. And they need what is effectively a ferry to take their people backwards and forwards to St Kilda. It's 40 miles west of the Hebrides, so it's no easy trip. And my skipper, Covey McKinnon, had been doing this on his trawler for many years. So the National Trust were happy with him as to be in charge of the ship. So having found a trawler in Denmark, eventually, she was brought over to Scotland. As a casualty, the delivery crew Noctan and Echo signed a pod off the bottom, and they had to close down an oil rig and every sort of terrifying nightmare. And I knew nothing of all of this. You know, as I say, my background was cooking and antiques. And I was thrown into the west coast of Scotland. I had to make the business work. Friends had invested, none of them investing very much, nothing more than £5,000. So if the whole business went belly up, it wouldn't matter that much to anybody. But, you know, one's pride and everything is such that you've told them, well, got to make it work. And we did. So this is the story of that escapade, which is in Mistress and Commander, my first book. And the problem really was that after a while, it became apparent that I would have to get my own maritime qualifications. I was being given the runaround by temporary skippers after the original one left. Frankly, if I was not prepared to provide their nighttime entertainment, they walked off, leaving us stranded in the Outer Hebrides, you know, with passengers. And I didn't have the qualifications, even though I'd been on the boat for most, whenever there was a problem, I was always there to make sure things went correctly. So it started off, and I managed to get, on this particular occasion, I managed to get a skipper who had all the qualifications. But of course, he knew nothing of the machinery. And a trawler has complicated machinery, you know, hydraulics, the engine. And we set off, and I rang up the engineer and said, "Hello, Bill, it's Amelia. Tell me how to start the engine." I mean, I was terrified. This is enormous, enormous marine diesel engine. Anyway, you know, I described it as a red dragon because it was this painted red and lying there in the engine room, kind of faintly threatening. And dear Bill, he then rang me up every day on his way into the fish market in Peterhead to tell me I needed to do this, to, you know, I needed to clean the oil filter. And I'd say, "Bill, I don't even know where the oil filter is." And then he'd describe it, and I managed to do it. But about 3 or 4 years of that, which brought the whole of my engagement with this boat called the Monaco up to 10 years, I thought, "Hello, I've had enough now." You know, working out at sea in February, we worked 11 months of the year. And also by then, my own family life had changed. Sadly, and totally unexpectedly, Digby had died. And that was something for anybody who loses a child. It's a different experience of life. And I needed, my eldest son Hugo was at boarding school. My husband was largely working in London. And I was pretty isolated and not happy with life. And I felt, I can remember clearly thinking, you know, does the rest of my life take place on the West Coast on a boat, you know, with bad weather and dodgy finances? Or am I going to do something? So I elected to leave the company. My ex-husband had wanted to get divorced. It was a dark time. But, you know, dark times breed resilience. Either you sink or you swim. And I think one has to, it's not easy, and different people obviously deal with things differently. But I do remember one day waking up and thinking, "Amelia, this won't do. You've got to get a grip. You know, life doesn't come to you. You have to make it happen," in my experience. So I set about finding a job. Rang up a couple of girlfriends who were extremely helpful and sent out some CVs. And this is the beginning of pages from my passport, the change from the West Coast, when I began to think about getting how I get a job, bearing in mind I had no qualifications for anything apart from driving a large boat around the West Coast, which was not going to get me very far when I wanted to get away from that. But I managed to get a job as a tour leader in Russia, Czech Republic. And then I looked around thinking, well, what else do I know? I know the West Coast of Scotland. And I got in touch with Hebridean Island Cruises, based in Skipton, persuaded them to let me be an onboard guide. And, you know, I mean, most guides are very good at history, of course, which there's plenty of in Scotland, colourful history. Well, I really was better at telling them what the boat we were passing was doing, what the name of the skipper was, what his dog was called, where he lived, what the boat was carrying. A different sort of guiding. And I think people enjoyed it. So then I discovered that company had been sold specifically the new owners wanted to set up an international ship to mimic their ship operating, still operating, Hebridean Princess, very successful, operating on the west coast of Scotland. So remote islands, distant archipelagos, but the clientele, the passenger complement, remain and certainly were extremely intelligent, well-travelled, educated bunch. And so my thoughts were that I needed to create something that combined the remoteness of the West Coast with the history of wherever the ship was. And it was hugely important that people would know where they were. I feel strongly that people have splendid holidays and very often come home without a clue as to where they've been.
It's very true that, yes.
And it's not good enough. It's not good enough in the sense that it's quite rude to whatever country it is they're visiting. So I felt very strongly, and I obviously still do, about that. Anyway, Michael Fenton, very astonishing, I wrote him a letter saying, you know, if you've got this new ship, you need me. I'm two people rolled into one. I can assess what the ship can do, and I can write you a jolly good tour. And much to my astonishment, he said, I think we do. So off I went, I started off in Norway, because the Scottish link's there. And yes, that was quite an adventure, getting marooned, left abandoned on an uninhabited island. Clearly I got off because I'm here, but it was frightening. And then all around the Baltic, I was paid to explore. Absolutely phenomenal. I mean, an amazing job. This was the late 90s, and the world was a very different place. Women, you know, didn't wander around the place on their own very much. People's travel expectations were very different from now. There wasn't such a thing, really, as expeditionary cruise ships. I have a very low opinion of 90% of them because they're too big. You know, if you're actually going to explore, they need to be small, no more than 100 people. So that was what I was doing. And from northern Norway to Singapore was my patch, which get all the way through the Red Sea. And just the more abstruse and remote the islands, the more fun it was for me. Getting to them was always a real issue for me. But islands, you know, islands necessarily have interesting histories, really. 90% of them, they've got something. Mm. Even if it's only, you know, one thing. Why does that community exist? What are they doing? Mm. You know, I mean, there was one island I found in Norway called Espevar, which had a medieval lobster catching area, you know, where they corralled the lobsters and then they would sell them to the ships going up and down the coast. You know, it never crossed my mind there was such a thing as a sort of specially built cleft in the rocks of the island for corralling lobsters. I mean, you come across the most fascinating things. So I was very fortunate. Very fortunate.
And Amelia, when we talk to guests, often, you know, they've done one thing or, you know, followed one particular career path and then stopped and, you know, gone off, you know, left field and done something else, often fascinating. It seems to me that what you're doing now or have done more recently is more of a kind of segue. And I just wondered if you could talk about, you know, how you transitioned from all of those adventures to being an award-winning author and whether there are any surprises along the way.
The surprises are numerous and I find rather extraordinary to remember in many ways. But the move, I suppose, into writing was because in the course of this, it may possibly have come across that I'm quite determined about various aspects.
Indeed, it has.
And on that basis, I felt very strongly that when I got divorced, and that has been a constant theme from all the way through my life. You know, my son Hugo had a pretty rough time with his younger brother dying, and of course he'd known happy family life before, whilst Digby was alive, and before I got divorced. And I was absolutely determined to be somebody he could be proud of. That has been throughout my single life, if you like, an abiding determination. And I found, you know, when I was doing the work and traveling, and Hugo came with me many, many times, which was enormous fun. So that was good. But I found, I started again, I came to London. There was a moment when I thought, well, Hebridean Island Cruises, there will come a moment when they think, hello, we don't need Amelia anymore. We've set up our programs. The ship is operating. And I think I thought, I'm going to jump before I'm pushed. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do something, I must get on and do it. What am I going to do? Well, I've got this experience of travel, so I will set up a travel company. So I set up my own travel company with various determinations involved with that, which are different. But then in the course of my social life, which again, I had to start again, I found people didn't really believe that I had, you know, got an Arctic trawler and done. And that annoyed me. Hello, I have, you know, done it. So I thought, well, I'll write about it. And I met a man at a party who actually was a ghostwriter, very nice man. And I gave him a bit about my background and said, do you think there's a book here? And hardly surprisingly, he said, well, it is. And so I employed him for 3 years. And we never got beyond chapter two, which irritated me hugely. He wanted the book to be something that I didn't. He wanted it to be a travelogue, really, of the West Coast. And a friend who was a travel writer said, well, just for goodness sake, do it yourself. So after 5 years of sort of playing with the idea of a book, I thought, well, right. So I sat down and wrote the book, Mistress and Commander. I then was advised to send it to Sandstone Press, sent it to them in September. And, you know, anybody who's written a book knows that you have to send the first three chapters. So I did that. But I did write the whole thing because I thought, well, I look really silly if they were to come back and say, we like your book, send us the rest. And I haven't written it, so that won't do. So I did write the whole thing and I sent it to Sandstone Press. And 4 months later, not a squeak, 4 months later, an email popped up. We'd like to publish your book.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was, I was so fortunate. The first people I sent to the first publishing company, no agent, none of those things. And it was an extraordinary learning curve. The editor, Moira, was absolutely fantastic because, you know, well, I've always described it as my wayward prose. You know, it was pretty unsophisticated. So that was good. And it's been it's in its, I think, third or fourth reprint now. And I've been fortunate enough to be invited to lots of book festivals, which I enjoy. Who could not enjoy a good book festival? And then I thought, well, hello, there's more story here. Why don't I write about the travel places? Because many places I went to were, and remain actually, very remote, with fascinating people doing interesting things, who, again, like the West Coast and the shipping communities, were very supportive for me. And I don't suppose, you know, the village chief in Madagascar even knows I've written a book, but you know, nonetheless, he's in there, and he was a fantastic fellow in his white dinner jacket, which he'd got from somewhere or other for when the passengers turned up. I mean, marvelous stuff.
I love it. You can't really tag him, can you, to say, oh, I've just published a book and you're written in it.
No, I can't, but I have actually been in touch with the Durrell, a man who was head of the project there, and just said, because there's a certain amount about him in the book too. And so I've tried to tell those who are actually, you know, part of the story, that it's happened, because rather frighteningly, it is on Audible, which I was asked to do, and found extremely difficult, actually much more difficult than writing it.
So Amelia, we normally ask people to talk about the emotions of, well, typically it's about the retirement process, and there's a real bereavement process for most people. Of course, you've been through that so sadly with your son in a completely different way. And when we're normally talking about this stage of life, we're sort of asking about, you know, how did you feel about things, and did you need support, and where did you get that from? And of course, yours has been so awful. As you say, I don't think anybody can imagine losing a child. It must be the worst thing in I think anybody's life, really, to be honest. You know, and our thoughts go with you on that. But can you just talk about, you know, thank you for talking about it and sharing it. You know, how did you feel, as much as you want to share on that, and where do you get support from that? I mean, you're enormously resilient. It's so inspiring. But there must have been some really big down days. You said it was dark times. You said it was dark times.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, obviously, the darkest time was when Digby died. But actually, the divorce is pretty dark too.
Yeah.
you know, it's a totally different sort of thing. It's a personal rejection.
Yeah.
Frankly, which, you know, I found difficult to deal with. For me, I know that doing things, being busy, helps me. Mm. When Digby died, you know, I wasn't able really to do anything. I can remember, you know, I had one girlfriend who, bless her, rang me up every day. And, you know, and I'd be sitting on the sofa crying. And I can remember one morning thinking, you know, this can't go on, Amelia. You know, she can't carry on ringing you up every day. I did kind of discover, I suppose, that I've fallen back on it, or I've referred to it within myself many, many times, that when times, for me anyway, are really dire, it's a case of hanging on in there. Just hang on in there. You know, try not. I mean, I never took to drink. I'm more likely to take to chocolate than drink, actually.
Oh, bless you.
You know, if you hang on in there, keep going out for a walk, you keep doing things, you don't let yourself, you know, slide into drink or something awful, if you can possibly manage it, one day things will look better. Yeah. One day things will turn around. You won't know when, you won't know why, but you wake up one morning not feeling as bad. For me, that was how I found. And when things are tough and feel lonely, you know, you just make yourself do something, even if it's something very small, you know. And if you happen to make a, you know, a pot of jam or a cake or a biscuit or, I don't know, for somebody else, and you take it to somebody local or you take it to wherever it may be, it'll make you feel better as well as them having something nice. And it's just, and a little tiny steps, really, no matter how small, will grow and make you feel stronger, in my experience anyway.
Yeah,
that's very affirming. That's great advice. You've reinvented yourself several times. You've kind of got up and carried on marching. I just wonder what's next. You know, what's what's on the horizon? Are there more reinventions to come, or?
I'm debating whether I have another book.
Okay.
Interestingly, well, for me, I find it extraordinary. I think Victoria, well, there is a love element of pages from my passport, as there was in Mistress and Commander. And, you know, people have asked me for the result of the answer, or not the answer, but how it turned out. And actually, hello, I won't tell you that. That's my secret.
But that's refreshingly unusual these days, to be honest, Amelia.
And it's very, I hope. I think the interesting thing is the comments about the love element in pages from my passport. People have enjoyed because it's not hugely explicit. Yeah. I mean, we're definitely not talking Shades of Grey or whatever it was. it's discreet. It's old fashioned, if you like. But they have enjoyed that. And I actually quite like to try and write a novel.
It's going to be the Shades of Grey bit then.
No, it's not. But I would like to try and draw. I'm kind of thinking, I've got ideas sort of rolling around the back of my head, which might be a slightly sort of teenage type novel.
Oh, love it. And I love it, Amelia. I don't suppose you want to share that publicly, but you're not, you know, clearly where you were talking about things in the late 90s and things, you're not still in your younger phase of life like that. And I love it when we meet people who are thinking about what's next still, rather than just, you know, oh, you mentioned you bought a cottage, but, you know, I've bought a cottage and that's going to be it. I'll go walking to the beach or whatever. Just looking back, I suspect I feel a lot of empathy with you, I have to say.
I suspect
you're not somebody to spend a lot of time worrying about what might have been and all the rest of it. You tend to get on. But with hindsight, is there anything you would have done differently? And do you have any takeaways? I mean, you shared about just keep going, which I think is so important. And, you know, to hear that it one day will get better when you're in
the
place.
It will.
But
I think that's the most.
Yes.
The thing I've learnt most through the grim moment.
Yeah. But anything else that you would say to people who are not having an easy time at this stage of life? It's surprisingly difficult. I don't know whether you know many people who've left corporate life and retired, but it can be a really difficult time for them. They go through a bereavement process.
They do. I think it's probably in the course of corporate life, you've met a lot of people. And I think to continue to try and meet people and to hear what they have to say about their lives and what they're doing you know, here I am busy chattering away and talking to you, but actually, and it's trite to say, but listening to people and asking them a question, if you're feeling, you know, if you're feeling a little bit down and not having a great day, then I deflect people by asking them lots of questions. And people like to be have an interest shown in them. You know, if you ask them questions about what they're doing, and obviously it's very easy at this time of year, you know, where are you spending Christmas and those things? It means you don't have to answer yourself. And that helps. It gives you a time to regroup. I think one of the things that I find very helpful if I'm feeling a bit awkward or possibly a bit at a loss, which perhaps a social occasion, if you're just newly retired, can easily feel, well, you know, I used to be somebody, but I'm nobody now. Well, that's no good at all. You're still somebody of great interest and have done things. I think then having a few, three or four questions up your sleeve, as you might say, where you could, I mean, all of this is quite well documented. It's not rocket science at all, but it is helpful. I nearly always, when I go somewhere, I just think, well, you know, okay, it's nearly Christmas now. I can ask people, you know, where are they? Do they have family coming? And then perhaps you meet somebody who says, well, actually, no, I haven't got any family. And so you have to try and regroup a bit on that one. But it's a sort of two-edged sword in the sense that, you know, people like to be asked about themselves, but also it gives you time to sort of regroup yourself if you're feeling a little at a loss.
Really helpful. And thank you so much for sharing. and we wish you all the best with everything that comes in the future. I'm sitting here, I have to confess, Amelia, wondering who plays you in the movie.
Oh, good one, Trevor. Very good. I love it.
Well, you might want to think about that. Anyway, it's delightful to meet you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's very nice to meet you. I find it wonderful that these days, you know, we can be spread across the country, the British Isles, the world, and talk to each other. It's marvellous. You meet all sorts of people. It's very interesting.
It's very inspiring. Thank you so much, Amelia.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. And I hope next time in Yorkshire, I'll meet you, Victoria.
I'd love that.
Very good. Thank you.
Well, that was some story, wasn't it? Unusual. Unlike many of the people that we have interviewed, who, you know, had quite a corporate life. You know, she's sort of invented her life.
Yes, she has.
And reinvented it. And as you were saying, the whole part of her life, which is dark times, and her strategy for getting through those times was inspiring, absolutely inspiring. She said, dark times breed resilience. And I'm definitely going to take that away. I think it's very true. And she's had a rich life with real ups and downs. I thought it was inspiring.
I mean, more than most people ever will have, I think. And it's very easy to see somebody like Amelia and think, oh, you know, it's easy for you. And I think that's one of the things when we do the workshops and we talk to people who have gone through retirement, I think there's a tendency for everybody to think it's easier for everybody else because it's difficult for me because, and not to realise that it's probably difficult for everyone. And we've all of us got to find new routes at different stages for different reasons. I mean, I just thought she was such a good inspiration for anybody who is facing retirement, sort of unretirement, whatever. And that bit about, you know, I had to make it work. And I just thought, you know, that kind of, sometimes when things are really difficult, the easier that life is in terms of money and people around us and things, the less you have to work. She had absolutely nothing in her life at that time. I mean, she still had her son, Hugo, and clearly he's wonderful and means so much to her. But, you know, she hadn't got money, she hadn't got relationships, all the rest of it. So she said, I had to make it work. And I think sometimes, you know, it's putting yourself in that mentality that I've got to make this work. What am I going to do? Because it's so easy to give up. I mean, Trevor, you've talked about it being really hard when you first retired, if you like. I mean, you had a lot going on at that stage, but as you sort of came out of some of the challenges, did you feel like there were options about, am I going to make this work? You know, what am I going to do next? Do I just kind of drift or do I do something? I mean, that's kind of the choice, isn't it, often?
Yeah, I did drift for at least a year. I was busy. I did stuff, but you know, it was kind of filling time.
Yeah.
I remember waking up one morning and saying, right, I'm going to do some things I've never done before.
Yeah.
And I took a training course. I bought an old motorcycle. I did all sorts of stuff just because.
Yeah.
And this is what Amelia was saying. You get to a point where you say, this can't go on.
Yeah.
I have to do something. Yeah. And as she said, you know, from that, everything springs. You know, opportunities, you make your opportunities. Opportunities come your way if you do stuff.
Yes.
And I also liked her saying, you know, when I'm feeling a bit down, I just go and talk to people and ask them about their story.
I'll tell you what I really also liked. The bit I wrote down here, there's going to come a stage when they don't need Amelia in the future. And I decided I would jump before I was pushed. And I didn't think people do that enough, you know. I don't think they kind of anticipate, particularly when you've been in an organisation all your life. It's frightening. It is terrifying to think of life without that corporate. However much you love or hate it, it's the life on your own is really hard. So people just don't do anything. But actually this bit about be in control of it, think and plan ahead, as she did. So she said, then she wrote to people. Michael Fenton, you know, she wrote a call to him thing about you need me and you need a skipper and you need a tour guide. And he said, I think I do. And, you know, that bit about going out and creating your own job, actually looking at what's out there, what have I got? I thought that was fantastic and it's such a good story to share with others, because you don't have to apply for things that are out there. Those will probably not come to people who are retired.
Yeah.
You have to go and say, this is why. And the other thing she said, what was it about connections? You've got to continue to meet people. That was what she said. And that's such a good message at any stage of life, to be honest. But it happens naturally in corporate life, even though it's quite narrow, the people you meet.
Yeah.
That was
the other thing that came across, you know, she described herself as a storyteller, not an author, which I thought was great. But, you know, despite the fact that she's made this all happen, she also felt incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
But she made her own luck.
She absolutely made her own luck. Yes.
So if you have been as inspired as we have been with Amelia and all of our guests, do join us again for a regular catch up. We are covering everything from finances, sitting down with your family, how you work out what you're going to do, the whole plethora of things that you might do as you prepare for your unretirement.
And do look at our website, next-up.com, and join us for our next podcast, who will always be a fantastic guest with insights that will help you on your journey.
Thank you.